dancing in the dark. Till the tune ends, we're dancing in the dark. And it soon ends, we're waltzing in the wonder of why we're here. Time hurries by, we're here and gone, looking for the light of a new love to brighten up the night. I have you, love, and we can face the music together, dancing in the dark. What though love is old, what though song is old, through them we can be young. Hear this heart of mine, make yours part of mine, dear one. Tell me that we're in the wonder of why we're here. Time hurries by, we're here and gone. And we can face the music together, dancing in the dark.
That's Crosby's wonderful record of Dancing in the Dark, the original, the first recording of Dancing in the Dark. And I'm Jonathan Schwartz. You were the most famous humanoid on the planet. How does it feel?
I'm all right. I don't feel tip-top every day unless I have my Metamucil. Mm-hmm. But I'm okay. I mean, I have no complaints. I'm here. If I want French toast, I can order it. I'm here. It's better to be here than there, wherever there is.
I've been reading any number of things that have been written about you. God, the number of things through the years, not because of the producers.
If you want to do your homework on me, Jonathan Schwartz, then you got to take at least a day and a half, collect all the interviews, all the nonsense, but there is one great one, and I think you probably read that one, and that's the Kenneth Tynan profile. Mm-hmm. And he was easily as talented as I was as a writer, so... that was a thrilling experience.
I consider Tynan to be one of the great figures of the 20th century. If I were to make a list of 20 people, Jonathan Miller would be on that list.
Yes, yes.
In my opinion, yeah, Noel Coward would be on Orson
Jonathan
Welles.
Jonathan as a doctor or as a
as a singing doctor.
As a singing doctor, right.
But think of him. I mean, he's a director of opera. He's one of the funniest men I've ever seen. I mean, he's an absolute doctor, a highly skilled medicine man.
Yes, I always wanted to hang around with him just in case, you know, something went wrong. I would always say, Miller, here, under my chin, by my neck, something, it's throbbing,
But it would be Jonathan Miller. I saw...
You think you love him because his first name was Jonathan. I mean, is there... Because when I was a kid, I loved... instead of the Dodgers, I loved the Giants because there was a guy called Mel Ott.
Yeah. Remember his batting stance with
his left foot way up in the air, or his right foot, he was a right-handed hitter. Uh-huh. So his left foot went way up in the air, and he would lace a ball into the stands. That was Mellot.
Well, you know, it's an interesting, perhaps narcissistic point that you bring up about me.
Yeah.
I admire Jonathan Tunick, who...
See, all the Jonathans.
Who creates the arrangements, or works with Sondheim very deeply.
I wonder if you liked you were crazy about Jonathan von Stupp, who was a Gestapo commandant.
I didn't
in
know
Dusseldorf,
that.
Yeah, during the war. Killed a lot of Jews, this guy.
Do you know how many?
Oh, at least 13, you know. But anyway, no, I'm kidding about that guy. The very few Germans have a Jonathan there in the front. Front from the name. They usually have a Jürgen or a Schmeisser, an English, but, you know, one of those.
Say Jonathan in German.
Jonathan. It would not, there's no th. Jonathan. Here, front, center. Turn around. All right. Dismissed. You know, Jonathan. Now, talking about, I loved your father. You know, I met him. He was a very dear man.
Yeah.
He was a sweet man, and you could see the melody. He was a melodist, and you could see the melody in his face.
There were two people. Many people made him laugh, but there were two people who made him laugh almost viciously loudly. You are one of them, and the other is Alan King.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, Alan. You know, Alan grew up in my neighborhood. His real name is Erwin Nyberg, and I used to get him on the basketball team in the schoolyard. And he married Janet Sprung, the richest girl in town, because her father owned Sprung Monuments. When you died, you had to get a Sprung Monument. There were no other monuments in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, you know. If you wanted a monument, you wanted a headstone, you had to go to Sprung Monument. He's still married to her. They married about 50 years. I mean, it's amazing. He's a terrific guy, always adorable, always a wonderful stand-up comic. In earlier years, he would have been a terrific Max Bialystock. You know, he could have played. He could have been right on Broadway at the St. James Theater doing Max Bialystock.
My father was present at a couple of 2,000-year-old man party moments.
Ah, yes, I remember.
He was not there at Leone's, the Moss Hart night,
I think he was at the Billy Rose, there was a Billy Rose night on Central Park West, and I'm pretty sure he was there and screaming.
Boy, he hated Billy Rose.
Yeah, well, he...
There was a party once, and... the waitress came to my father and with a big plate of things, and he said, "You know, I'm in the mood. I think I'd something little to eat tonight. I think it'll be Billy Rose."
That's funny.
Now, the song you picked here, I've asked you about songs that have had an influence in your life, and you picked my father's song, "Dancing in the Dark," either by courtesy design or improvisation, but probably from your heart.
It's a great tune. It's one of the great tunes of all time. And
why did you pick Bing Crosby's record? In other words, what impact did that record have on you, Mel?
When my brother Irving bought us a Victrola, and he bought us some red RCA Victor Toscanini records, and he bought us Russ Colombo and Bing Crosby records, I was I'll tell you how old I was. I was in, let's say, 26, 33. 26 to 33 is 6, all right? Because 26 to 30 is 4 years, 7. Okay, I was 7 years old in 1933. And my brother Irving was 10, he was 17 then, and he was into music and jazz and classical as well as popular music. And we had this Victrola, a wind-up. And every morning when I would get up to go to school, my mother was wonderful. She was like a restaurant. I mean, you know, my brother Lenny wanted a banana sandwich for breakfast, so he got it. I wanted French toast. My mother would make it. My brother Irving, you know, wanted something more substantial, like, I don't know, you know, like scrambled eggs and stuff. So my mother was like a short order cook. She, you know, she never complained. She did everything. My father died when I was 2 years old. He was only 34. He died of tuberculosis, leaving my mother, who was then 30, with four children, a 12-year-old boy, a 10-year-old boy, an 8-year-old boy, and a 2-year-old boy, and a 6-year-old boy, and a 2-year-old, four years between me and my brother Bernie. Four boys, and still too young to work and bring in any money. My father's father and mother lived in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. He owned some kind of a herring importing company, and he was very generous and very sweet, and he would give my mother a stipend from time to time to keep us going. And but my mother was a hero. I mean, I didn't walk till I was four. She carried me everywhere. She loved me. She adored me. And I think that love is, you know, they say, oh, comics didn't get enough love, so they want it from the audience. And that's bullshit. I mean, if anything, comics got plenty of love and didn't want it to stop. Mm-hmm. And so ask the audience for a continuum of that wonderful affection they got when they were little.
Let me ask you something. Do you feel that embarrassment is the funniest emotion? And if so, how do you manipulate it to be continuously funny?
Well, let me do a plug. In the Producers, which is there on Broadway.
I heard the closing notice is up.
If we had this conversation 10 years from today, you could say that. Mm-hmm. But Gary Beach, who plays Roger Debris, the gay director, and is even more gay, common law assistant, Roger Bart, who plays Carmen Gia, stumble in on a fight on the stage between Max Bialystock and Leo Bloom, played by the great Nathan Lane and the fabulous Matthew Broderick. So Matthew Broderick is on top of Nathan Lane on the floor trying to get some books that are under Max Bialystock, who doesn't want to give him the books because he wants to turn the books in and get a good deal with the authorities. So Broderick is on top of Lane, and he's just pumping on top of him saying, give it to me, give it to me, give it to me. And Gary Beach and Roger Barth rush in and say, congratulations, because, you know, Springtime for Hitler is a huge success. And they're watching Matthew on top of Lane saying, give it to me, give it to me. And they just take each other's hands and then swing them back and forth. I mean, so that mistake makes for one of the biggest screams. And then, of course, Bialystock, you know, sees him and screams, you lousy fruit, you ruined me, and they have this big fight, and, you know. But
about embarrassment as a funny emotion?
Well, I mean, I think Bloom is very embarrassed, caught in this, you know, in this predicament that he didn't intend.
Give me an example, if you will, of a moment in your life, either a comedic or personal moment, that caused you embarrassment.
I don't know if this is embarrassment. I mean, this was really panic and embarrassment. My first job as a performer, and only job, on the Show of Shows, I was one of the writers with Mel Tolkien and Lucille Callan and Tony Webster at that point. This was very early. This was not Caesar's Hour yet with the Neil Simon and Woody Allen and Larry Gelbart and all. This was just Tolkien and me and Callan and Webster. And Sid Caesar knew I did a cat sound.
Wow.
I do a good cat sound. Mm-hmm. And we had a dial M for money in which Sid would back up in a darkened bedroom and step on a cat's tail, and then that would give him away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd have. So he said, you do the cat. Mm-hmm. I said, sure, I'll do the cat. So the sound, you know, this is Show of Shows. I mean, it's a big broadcast. Mm-hmm. I mean, millions of people, you know, so the sound man set me up with a mic.
And live.
Live, right. And he said, you know, when I point to you, make the cat sound. So Sid is backing, starts backing up, and he points to me, and I go, shh, shh. My mouth is dry. I am very embarrassed. I can't make the. And everybody's nervous and worried and panicked. And, you know, what are we going to do about this cat sound? Because everything hinges on the lights going on and the discovery once we get. So I struggled and none of it was acceptable. He kept it off mic until he could get. And then finally I came out with. And saved the day. Now. Strangely enough, that cat sound is in, again, the Producers on Broadway because Bialystock wants to defeat Springtime for Hitler. So
let me ask you.
He uses a black cat.
Do you feel?
I do that cat.
Do you feel honestly? I'll keep that in mind, and people hearing the cat will now know that it's you.
I do that cat.
Do you
cat.
Feel it's honestly necessary to pursue publicity for this show?
No, not at all.
At this point?
No, not at all. Don't need it. Don't want it. another person seeking tickets would just make for more trouble. There are lines. There's, you know, and I have a lot of Jewish relatives who call day and night to please get them a ticket. You know, I say, you know, there's a finite number of seats. There's a finite number of tickets. I'm only allowed a few tickets, house seats every night. And you know, I call me in November, you know, because I'm – so we don't – I don't want to sell any more tickets. I mean, that would be silly. But what – you know why I'm here? You know why I'm here?
I don't.
Well, there's a $10.50
well, that goes know, without saying.
A little premium here. But besides the $10, I want people – I would like people to, if they could, listen to the album because I'm very proud to finally – you know, I do a song and every other movie and to finally have created a score, you know. I've written like 16, maybe 17 new songs for this show in addition to the ones I wrote for the film, which were Springtime for Hitler – Prisoners of Love, and Haben Sie gehört, Das Deutsche Bahn.
My own thought, and I'm filled with sadness at the moment, is that you are here because of a physical attraction to me.
Ah, that, you know, when they ask me, you know, everybody, you know, on Broadway, you know, you say, are you gay, are you straight, you know, whatever. And I usually say I'm about 78% straight, you know. Mm-hmm. If a gorgeous guy walks in the room, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I would normally say that having grown up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, it's not a thing that made any sense to us, you know. Mm-hmm. Here we were just trying to go out on a date and maybe if we were lucky get soul-kissed, you know. Mm-hmm. So that other – the other thing is much too beyond our ken, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Maybe Ken is that guy.
Maybe
22%.
Ken. You know, it was started you know, with the Barbie, but it could end up with Ken, you know?
Crosby, Dancing in the Dark. Why did you pick it?
Oh,
as a part of your life.
My brother got this record, put it on, and every morning I'd ask my mother to play it. And I'd hear Crosby singing exactly like this. Dancing in the dark till the tune ends. We're waltzing in the dark.
We're dancing in the dark.
Dancing, and it soon ends. And we – I'm just going to take it out. And we can face the music together, dancing as we're dancing in the dark. Beautiful rendition. Now, when I was in the mountains working as a comic, the Jews would eat their chopped vegetables for lunch and covered with tons of sour cream. A slab of butter on a heel of pumpernickel, enough cholesterol to kill King Kong, you know, in one meal. And here they're eating all this stuff, and then they go on the porch and they rock, and a lot of them love Dancing in the Dark, which is a very tricky song because it ends with Dancing in the Dark. It's very high, you know. So if you don't start Dancing in the Dark in a lower register, you're not going to make the top. And a lot of the Jews unwittingly would start dancing. They would rock and they would sing it like this. Dancing in the dark. And well, you know, that's a stroke. You know a stroke is coming up if they start there. And it soon ends. We're all dancing in the dark. And it soon ends. And we can face the music. Says I'm in. Dancing, yes, we're dancing in the dark. Bang. Stroke. Dead on the porch. Another Jew's killed by dancing in the dark, you know. But because it's a tricky melody. And you
do you
must...
know that that beautiful melody was written in the length of time it takes to play it?
Is this true?
Well, I'm his son. I should know.
Oh, my God. It's beautiful. It's one of the great, you know.
I think it's one of the most dignified romantic melodies.
It is. I mean, it's a very, very classy, wonderful tune. They don't write melody. Nobody writes melody. I mean, Arthur Schwartz was – God said, you will write – you write melody.
Now, you mentioned Toscanini a moment ago. Well, one day shortly after Christmas in 1947, you may remember the big snowstorm, the blizzard of 47.
Yes.
My father had business downtown. We were at 74th and Madison, which was a two-way street at the time. Everything was two-way avenue.
Yeah, right. No, every street was two-way.
Absolutely. All the avenues until 1963. But anyway, the blizzard is incredible. Nothing is moving. My father has hired a limousine, and one slowly makes its way to us and stops under an irrelevant traffic light. And my father gets in. I'm right behind him.
Yeah.
And suddenly, I see over my father's shoulder, he's looking at an astonished Arturo Toscanini.
Where is Toscanini?
Sitting in the limousine. It's the wrong limousine. My father, mortified, talk about embarrassment, says, "I'm sorry. I thought you were the wrong car." Now, I bring up Toscanini because another of your selections, so to speak, music that's meant something to you, is the Toscanini recording of
Beethoven's Fifth.
Tell me why.
Because I was a little boy. I think I was 11 or 12. I was walking down one of the streets in Williamsburg, and there was a music store, and it was coming out of the door, and I heard these arresting four notes. I always loved music, and I loved, without realizing it, its strange permutations in mathematics. So I heard bup 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 ba. I said, "Well, that ain't bad, you know." I was about 12. I heard it, bup 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 ba, bup 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 bup. It was just incredible. I said, "This is." I knew it was genius. I didn't know what the hell it was. I didn't know anything about classical music. But for the 9 or 10 minutes it took, 12 minutes to finish, I was arrested there. And it was my introduction to classical music, and I ran in, and the record, I think, was $1.90 or something. It was expensive, too expensive for me. It was Toscanini conducting Beethoven's Fifth. So I begged, borrowed, and stole, and I got enough money, and I got it, and I brought it to our Victrola, and I played it day and night. I thought this was good stuff. And that opened the door. Well, it opened the door to Chopin and Rachmaninoff, you know, and Mozart and Bach and Brahms and all, you know, and these terrific, talented guys, you know.
You know, it's funny how enormous they all are.
Yeah.
But if you think of it this way, of just the mother saying, standing at her door, "Serge Rachmaninoff, you get in the house this minute by the time I count three."
Yes, right, right.
"Get in here."
I mean, these guys are so good. If you make a mistake, you go into a store and you say, "Give me the Schubert," and they give you the Schumann, you're okay. You know? you can't go wrong. Schumann is as good as Schubert. I mean, they're all
good. Yeah, but you
good.
Might get the Schoenberg.
Yeah. Well, Schoenberg was good, too.
I know. You know? In a different kind of way.
They're all good.
Let's hear your Beethoven right now. I'm Jonathan Schwartz. He is?
Mel Brooks.
Beethoven, Mel Brooks's choice.
Yeah.
Mel, I have a couple of quick questions that have to do with men and women who are either alive or dead. I'd love just your short opinions of them, because I've never heard you speak on the subject of Steve Sondheim.
Love Stephen Sondheim. I love I love his mind. He's so careful, and he cares about internal rhymes as well as the required rhyme. He does more. He is a genius in that he does a lot more than is required for lyrics, and he's a gifted melodist. I mean, his music is wonderful. His music always meets. His music always meets its emotional requirements, and that's
beautifully said.
The high mark, you know, of a good song.
You know what Roger said of Sondheim's melodies? That they all go dum ba da dum bum bum bum. Rogers, whose birthday you share, June 28th.
And your birthday.
And absolutely.
Jonathan Schwartz, Mel Brooks, and Richard Rogers all shared the same birthday.
Of course, mine was June 28th, 1973. Isn't that amazing?
Mine was June 28th, 1926. I mean, I was in the Franco-Prussian War, I think. I don't know what was going on then. But anyway, I love Stephen
Sondheim. Have you ever met him?
I met him once or twice. Mm-hmm. He's a wonderful game player. I mean, he's a very gifted.
Yeah. His house is filled with puzzles on the walls.
Gifted game
player. Framed puzzles.
And I met him through Martin Charnin, who's a friend of his. And, you know, Martin Charnin did the lyrics for Annie, you know.
And that springs Tom Meehan.
Oh, yeah, you know Tom Meehan. And Tom Meehan wrote the book for Annie, who's now written the book with Mel Brooks for
the
producers.
You must know the OODA dream.
Oh, yes. That's where we met. Martin brought Tom Meehan to a party, and he did his stuff from the New Yorker, which is an Ema. It's called Ema Dream.
The Ema Dream. That's right. Ema Sumac.
Ema Sumac has a dream in which he says everybody should introduce themselves by their first name. Unfortunately, everybody has a very strange little first name. So Ava Gardner comes in with Eva Braun, and they meet Ulu Grossbart. So it's Eva Ulu, and they meet Abba Eben. So it's Abba Ulu, Eva Abba. Wait a minute.
It just occurs to me.
Yeah.
Your wife performed this on television.
She did. That's why we met him. It was part of her first Anne Bancroft special on CBS. So
I knew Annie around the Two for the Seesaw days.
Great.
That was one of the most moving things I've ever seen on the stage. I assume you saw it.
You know, they made the movie.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Mitchum and Shirley MacLaine.
Right. And, you know, and they should have made it with Henry Fonda and Anne Bancroft.
Absolutely.
It was just a big, big mistake. You know,
but what a play and what a performance.
Anne Bancroft is one of the blessed, you know, with this incredible talent. She still has it. She just did up at the Villa a year or two ago. And I mean, you'll never see a performance as good. Philip Haas directed it. Sean Penn, Kristen Scott Thomas, and Anne Bancroft. And it's all about Tuscany, Florence to be exact. In the rise of the fascisti in 1936 or 37. It's just a fabulous movie that Philip Haas has directed.
Well, I've
Up at the Villa, if you can rent it.
I'm aware of it. Haven't seen it. Will rent it.
Yeah.
I think that she's one of the most unusual, one of the most comically articulate actresses I've ever seen. I love the closing of Kenneth Tynan's Profile of You, where she comes home from the studio and says, "Ah, Mel, acting is so hard, and you've been working all day writing, and you get a blank piece of paper, and you say, 'You see this? This is hard.'"
Yes.
And you're right. It's the hardest job there
is. Fill this blank piece of paper with thoughts. Right.
Several times down through the years, I have noticed...
She once said to me, I got so angry and I bit my knuckle. She said, "Don't you dare strike me. This is my instrument." She pointed to her body. You know.
What did you say?
I said, "Let's hear Melancholy Baby." So that was the end of that fight, you know.
You have said here and there, I've noticed it in interviews or somewhere, that you always aspired to be Frank Sinatra.
Always.
Why?
Well, I loved the ease, the grace, and the eloquence that Frank was blessed with when he sang. Every no matter what the tune was, if he liked it, his love of that song came through with such perfect resonance, and his use of vibrato. He only used it, you know, a lot of guys go, ah, 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 but Sinatra used such so little, and only when he needed it. He was such an exquisite artist, such a great singer, you know. And when he loved a tune, even if it was Saturday night, loneliest night in the week.
Listen to your K.
Yeah.
That's exactly what he does.
Yeah, well, he stressed exactly, you know. I think he got a lot from Billie Holiday, actually. I think he loved Billie Holiday, and a lot of Billie Holiday found its way into Frank's voice. Mm-hmm. And it was, we're all made by our influences. We're not spontaneous combustion.
You mean to tell me that David Brenner is in your life is a
well, anyway, so Sinatra, you know, has these influences, I'm sure. You know, it's well known that Tommy Dorsey's trombone and his breathing.
Right.
You know, the mellifluous sound of that trombone and the ability to breathe and hold a note was very important to Sinatra's development as a singer. And the stylings of Billie Holiday's when to jump in. You know, Billie Holiday was always a little late. It's always good to be a little late because then you have to catch up, and when you catch up, it's thrilling.
If you do it comfortably.
Yeah, if you
so
do
the,
it comfortably.
So that the audience is comfortable with you catching up.
And there are only a few artists that were Tony Bennett can do it.
Yep.
Ella Fitzgerald was a master at it.
There's a story which I know to be so. Eddie Fisher was singing, and he was falling way behind.
Yeah.
One of the musicians in the pit said to the other, I don't know about him, but I'm going home at 11.
That's very good.
Lady Day made it comfortable.
Yes, yes. The first record she ever made was...
Well,
what was that? Was
the mother-in-law thing that you've want to hear, but I want to get first. My
mother's
mother. It was with Benny Goodman. It was the first record she ever made, and we'll get to it.
Mother's son-in-law.
Son-in-law, right. But let's first hear, at your request, the early Sinatra, East of the Sun.
And there's a wonderful, listen for a wonderful Bunny Berrigan solo on that. That's thrilling. And a Johnny Mintz solo. He played clarinet in the Tommy Dorsey band. I was a drummer, so I know all this stuff. As a kid, I played drums. So you'll hear Bunny Berrigan, you'll hear Johnny Mintz, and it's one of the best records ever made because you got Sinatra, you got Bunny Berrigan, and you got Johnny Mintz.
Sun,
they've been a brightness.
West of the moon,
we'll be digging a glow.
We'll build a dream house,
a righteous path
of love,
where you can really lay it on me.
Near to the sun in the day,
we'll be jumping.
Near to the moon at night,
you'll be with me.
We'll live in a lovely way,
solitude, I'm hit.
Living on love and pale moon,
you're mellow.
Just you and I,
we'll nix the square
forever and a day.
So long, so long,
long. love will not die.
We're together forever.
We'll keep it that way.
Forever.
Up among the stars we'll find a harmony of light to a lovely tune. East of the sun and west of the moon.
On the June night, kiss me and hold tight.
East of the sun and west of the moon.
Well, all right then, take 'em, bunny.
Go, Sinatra, East of the Sun, Tommy Dorsey, by request, Mel Brooks. Mel, I mentioned I'm just shooting some names at you for you to get to give us an opportunity to hear what you have to say about things that I haven't heard you talk about. Have you read any Saul Bellow?
A little. I like Saul Bellow.
I just bring him up because he's my literary hero. I think you are mentioned in either Ravelstein or Humboldt's Gift.
Really?
There's a reference to you. I believe that to be so. If so, it's wonderful.
Oh, well, he's, you know, I'm honored because he's, you know, no bum, Bellow. Well, he's terrific.
He's also a major Jewish comedian. As well as a
that I don't know. I mean, in the writing,
a comedian in the literary sense.
In the literary sense, right.
But I feel that all comedians are tragedians
yes.
as well.
Well,
do you feel that's true about yourself?
Yeah. I think that we comedy is like Dr. Jekyll's antidote. You know, we are all Mr. Hyde. And we need something to get us back to Jekyll, to get us back to real life and happiness instead of the Sturm und Drang that is really our normal state. Our normal state for a Jew, a normal state is anxiety, unhappiness, misery. What's next? It's, you know, John Lahr's father, Bert Lahr, was in a dressing room after the opening night of Red Hot and Blue, in which he was a star. He was incredible. And Bert Lahr was crying, and somebody said, "Mr. Lahr, why are you weeping?" I mean, this, he said, "Oh, when am I going to get a show as good as this again?" So, Jews are wont to, you know.
John Lahr gave you a terrific review in The New Yorker.
Have
you seen the?
I saw the cover.
The cover.
Yeah.
What do you think about it?
I think it's the most amazing thing. I never saw a show that has a cover of The New Yorker.
Right. No, it's the first.
Yeah, there's a lot of people laughing, and there's Hitler in the middle.
And one guy who's furious.
Yes.
And
yes.
Who indeed is Hitler.
Yeah.
Sinatra got his own cover, but that seldom happens. And that was because of a John Lahr piece about Sinatra.
No kidding. You know, when Kenneth Tynan did The New Yorker thing, there was a little flap or something of me on it. That was very nice when he did that. He did like 40 pages of profile in New York, and then it wound up in his book. What's the name of his book?
Tynan's book? Well, the collection of the profiles is called Show People.
Show People, right.
The collection of the reviews is called Curtains.
Oh, I got it.
Then there's a collection of his letters put together by his wife, his widow.
Yeah.
And
she's gone now.
Kathleen. Yeah. I know that. One of the most beautiful women.
Yes. Gorgeous.
And then there is a book about Tynan that she wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So at least we had someone tracking Tynan, who would still be alive today if not for cigarettes.
I know. He used to when he interviewed me, he was like a portable oxygen.
Yeah, that was at the very end.
You know, and he had it stuck in his nose, and it was just so sad. And he was such a handsome kind of, you know, old-fashioned Byron-esque Englishman, you know.
And yet he was a delicious cad. He's responsible for Calcutta.
Fantastic, you know. Talented, very talented guy. I really loved him. Best interview ever, as far as I was concerned. You know, nobody ever really caught me No, as exquisitely as he did, you know.
With the bird dong, the whole scene, he was there for that
He
film.
Was there for High Anxiety. There was some bird shit that got on him, too. You know, I said, well, these are the perils. You know, you want to be –
that was David Brenner.
If you're on a movie set, you know. You
got on him.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a couple more things, and then we'll hear Billie Holiday, and then we'll call it a
great
conversation, which I've enjoyed, obviously.
Well, I'll be back again. You know, I'm going to.
You'll never be back. This is the last time we will ever see each other. You know that, and I know it.
No, it's not true. I'm going to California, mm-hmm. which is just a place that Jews wait to get back to New York. Mm-hmm. When, you know, it's in between planes. Mm-hmm. So I live in California, and mm-hmm. I'll be there for 3 or 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. I'll come back. I guess we'll be nominated for some Tonys. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'll come back and see what's happening with that.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean you and I will ever see each other again.
But I'll be pushing that CD again, the cast album of the producers.
Yeah, I understand.
Which I hope you're going to mention sometime in the middle of all of this.
So the producers? There's an album?
There's a whole thing.
There's
a guy from Sony sitting out there that's fainting because he said we talk about the album. I mean, we've never mentioned it.
I had heard that the producers was having a hard time finding a label. You say you found a label and there is a record?
He's kidding, folks. There was a fight. There was actually fist fights with Universal and Sony and all these, you know, the many, many Warner Brothers, many labels wanted to record our cast album. And we took Sony. I only took Sony for one reason. There was a guy called Peter Gallup. I don't know who the hell he was. We had a run-through before we went to Chicago, our last run-through in a rehearsal hall. And Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane were cutting up. It was a thrilling, you know, it was like the gypsy run-through before you go out of town. And it was at the Duke Studios of 42nd Street. And this guy, kind of a thin guy with his legs crossed, kept exploding with laughter but not letting it out, just continually exploding. And I said, who the hell is that guy? I said, he was laughing like to beat the band. I love that. And he said, well, his name is Peter Gelb, and he's head of Sony Classical. I said, well, why is he here? Whose friend is he? He says, he really, you know, he's interested in doing the cast album. Mm. You know, they do classical stuff and they do all kinds of stuff, cast albums. And
Tony Bennett.
Yeah. So I said, classical? Hey, this sounds good. So I met with him. It turned out that he started off as a little kid as Vladimir Horowitz's press agent and worked up later in life to become Vladimir Horowitz's manager and was the first one that took him to Europe. Mm. When he was in his 60s, mm-hmm. early 70s. And the great stories about Vladimir. So I love this guy. So Jay Cooper, who's my lawyer, my music lawyer, Alan U. Schwartz, mm-hmm. is my lawyer.
I'm aware of that.
Yes. And Jay Cooper said, I like this guy, Peter Gelb. We worked with him before. And he said, we've gotten a little more expressions of payola up front. You know, we're like, we'll give you advances. Mm-hmm. I said, forget all that. Mm-hmm. Whatever upfront money is, put it into the advertising. Figure we don't need any money up front. And go with this guy, Peter Gelb, because he has the one ingredient that you always want around you when you're doing a show. He loves it. And forget, it'll always work. If there's love in it, if there's passion for it, it will always succeed. So I said, let's go with Peter Gelb and Sony Classical, and we're going to, you know, it's going to, this cast album will work. And we find out in the taxi coming over here, I find out that we are like number one and number two. I mean.
Just like you, number five, and Burt Reynolds, number six.
Oh, you remember that?
Yes, I do. Just tell us briefly about that. Then we'll go to Billie Holiday.
I can't believe. I forget what year it was. Maybe it was.
You were an actual box office hit.
Yeah, was it Ought 5? I forget the. I think it was 19 in the 80s that they had these lists of movie stars, people who were movie stars. And I came in because I think I had done High Anxiety, mm-hmm. and it was a big hit.
Did Sinatra ever acknowledge that, by the way?
Oh, he loved it. He sent me a note.
Did he? What did
he say? He said, if I'm ever sick. If I'm ever sick, I don't want anybody to take over but you, you know. And he loved Anne, and he loved a movie that she made called Fatso, starring Dom DeLuise, wrote it and directed it and was in it. And it was Frank Sinatra's favorite movie. And so, I mean, it was, I mean, he loved my anxiety. He repeated it on the phone once.
Did he really?
He called and said, I said, who's this? He said, anxiety. He just did the anxiety part of my anxiety. He said he loved it. I said, you're not offended? You know what I mean? He said, no, it was so good. He said, he wrote me a note, if you're ever sick.
I once watched a movie in his house next to him in a group of about 9 or 10 people.
Uh-huh.
I was anxious to talk music with him. So he's screening a movie after dinner. It's the longest movie. It's the Arthur Penn movie with Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson.
Oh.
A Western.
Oh, yeah.
What was the name?
One-Eyed Jacks? No, that was
Brando's. No, that's Nicholson in another film.
You sure it was a Western?
Well, there were horses. There was Nicholson.
Are you sure? You sure it wasn't about a sheriff in the South?
Wait, what?
Missouri Breaks.
Oh, Missouri Breaks. That's right. Missouri Breaks.
Okay. Right. Now, this is at least a 4-hour and 7-minute film. Very slow. Arthur Penn is trying to work his genius into it. And all I want, Sinatra's sitting there. And do you know, now, this is interesting. Do you know what Sinatra began to do? And no one interrupted him or told him to shut up. He began to tell us, the group, what was going on the screen. Now, you see, the Nicholson guy is going to come in. Now, here, the Nicholson's getting off his horse. He's going to go in that door there, and he's going to confront the Brando character. Now, see, there he goes. And, you know, he did this for the whole movie. And I'll tell you where I think it comes from what I've read. It was an old mogul thing, like Harry Cohn. When they would screen movies.
Yeah.
They would have people in their home.
Oh, so they would take charge of the movie.
They would take charge literally of the movie.
Right.
They would...
Host of the movie.
Exactly.
Yes.
And that's where I believe...
Now watch this, folks.
Yeah.
Because
now here comes Betty Davis.
A fly is going to land on her nose. She's going to try and swat it, but she misses and she hits her mouth and the fly gets away. Uh-huh. Right? I mean...
Now watch. See? Here it is.
See?
And then you dutifully have to respond.
Right. Weren't
you right, Frank?
Yeah.
How did you know that?
Yeah.
But this was an interminable movie, and he did that for 3 hours.
Wow. I mean, that is, you know, what you have is something that nobody, you know, you have the greatest singer that ever lived, pop singer that ever lived, and in a boring situation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's very, very unique.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, watching Missouri Breaks with Frank Sinatra instead of listening to him sing Saturday Night is the Loneliest Night in the Week.
I want to talk with him about the recordings, about music, about the songs, about the songwriters, about what key, why E flat, why didn't he take something down a half a tone? And there he is narrating Midnight Breaks.
Yeah, you're right, because whenever Sinatra, whatever key he locked into, he got there.
Yep.
Even though it wasn't even in his range.
Now,
he was dedicated to being, you know, a great musician. He made it.
There's no question. Now, Billie Holiday, you've picked actually the very first record she ever made with Benny Goodman on it. How come?
Well, I think Giants of Jazz sent me the Benny Goodman tapes, and there was Billie Holiday singing with Benny Goodman. And I just played it over and over and over and over. And I didn't realize, you just, for the first time, you told me that this was actually the first recording she ever made.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my mother's son-in-law because you get the best of Goodman, you get the best of Billie Holiday. I mean, it's just a gift from the gods to get a record like that.
Here it is. Thank you.
broker or banker, nor will the reader simply be my mother's son-in-law. Needn't even think of trying to be a mighty social lion, sipping tea if you'll be my mother's son-in-law. Ain't got the least desire to set the world on fire, just wish you'd make it proper to call my old man Papa. You don't have to sing like Bledsoe, you can tell the world I said so. Can't you see you've got to be my mother's son-in-law?
A gift from the gods, and a gift from Mel Brooks. Three quick personal questions and we're done.
Never mind that shit. You're going to play the CD?
Which CD is this? Finian's Rainbow?
Right.
We got Finian's Rainbow here. We got Guys and Dolls here.
Yeah. Never mind that shit. Here comes Mongo.
This is what I want to ask. For a man in his 70s, you look to be in fairly good health.
Well.
What is your cholesterol?
I take 10 milligrams of Zocor. Mm-hmm. So my cholesterol is somewhere between 141 and 170. It's
141 to 170? Great.
It's great. I just take it because there's a lot of death from heart attack in my family, in the genes. So it's just.
If you didn't take Zocor, would it be elevated?
It would be. It'd go up to 180 or something, but even that's okay.
Still in total control.
But you know, it's a talisman. You know, you take it, you say, oh, I'll take this little bit of, you know, whatever is Lipitor, whatever those stupid things are. Oh, I'll take this, I won't die, you know. You make a deal with the devil, you know, or a deal with God.
Well, I've always felt that anything and every product in drugstore should be called No Die.
No Die, right. You know you're smart.
Yeah, I'd like that white container there of No Die. Who is your best friend?
Give me
friend?
That big thing of No Die there, whatever. I'll take all the No Die.
I'll buy the store.
Right.
In a last desperate effort, who is your best friend aside from, let's say, Anne?
Oh, I mean, I have many, many, many friends.
Name three or four with whom you're in touch on a daily basis or weekly basis.
Well, do you know the memory expert, Harry Lorraine?
Really?
So Nan and I, Harry and Renee Lorraine. Uh-huh. Renee is his wife. I'm going to see them tonight. We always rent a car somewhere in the south of France, and we drive through Italy, and we end up in Venice. I mean, and we do that almost every summer. So, and he's wonderful. He's got a great memory, and
well, he better after all this.
Except when he's driving, he doesn't know where he's going. But otherwise, he's great.
Are you in any touch at all with Woody Allen?
No, I don't. I really don't know Woody. I mean, Woody and I worked together briefly, and tangentially, we might bump into each other once, you know, at Elaine's. I'll come over to the table, you know, and hello, how are you? And you know, but we never hung out.
What did
together.
You think of Annie Hall?
Wonderful movie, wonderful, funny, touching, a great movie. You know, he's a great movie maker. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm grateful to him for all the good stuff he's done. Zelig is one of my favorite. I play Zelig at least once a year. I love it so much.
Isn't that – and what a wonderful idea.
Yeah, great idea.
He's thinking of making a musical, by the way, of
Bullets
the
Over
Rose
Broadway.
What is it called?
I thought it was Bullets Over Broadway.
The Purple Rose of Cairo.
Ah.
Characters come off the screen.
Yes.
Neil Farrow's in the
movie.
Yeah,
yeah. You know, Buster Keaton did that originally in a movie where the characters actually came off the screen.
I didn't know that.
He was a projectionist, and the characters came off the screen. And
what did they do?
I don't know. I mean, they interacted, and then it turned out to be a dream. But it was a Buster Keaton movie in 1930. 21 or something, or maybe 28. Mm-hmm. But it was a very good movie. The Projectionist, I don't know what the hell it was called. But it was a Buster Keaton. It was great. And it's a good idea. I mean, a good idea is a good idea ad infinitum, forever and ever. And this Purple Rose of Cairo is a wonderful movie. I think Bullets Over Broadway has very funny, wonderful characters. And that, I would say to Woody, if I saw him, I'd say, why don't you do Bullets Over Broadway as a Broadway musical? Mm-hmm. Because a backstage musical is always a joy, celebrating mm-hmm. Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a sense, The Purple Rose of Cairo is a backstage film.
It's film. It's a backstage film.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now with this unbelievable success, golly.
I mean, the cover of The New Yorker, right? I mean, that's like legendary. I mean,
I'm just thinking of people in the theater who have worked and worked for years and years hoping for something like this.
You mean to get an old-fashioned musical comedy, something your
Absolutely.
Father would have written? You mean with melodies?
Well, yeah.
You mean with snappy lyrics?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you have to think back basically to, aside from the Disney stuff.
No, you have to go back
to My Fair Lady in 1956.
Or even go
Guys
back,
and Dolls.
Go back to Guys and Dolls Forum and go back to
Forum. Forum was not in the world of Guys and Dolls.
It was good. It was good. Bert Shavelov and Larry Gelb.
It had nothing to do with the quality. I loved it. But I'm talking about just the enormousness of its now becoming a part of the language. Notice that the cover of The New Yorker does not say the producers.
No.
It assumes that the reader understands the cartoon.
Yeah, true. It's part of the language
part of the American vocabulary.
Yeah.
There's so much of what you've contributed. I think there are ladies here.
Yeah.
That's a part of the American vocabulary.
Yes, when you got it, flaunt it.
Right? And you wash up, I'll wash up, you say Francis. Right. There are any number of things that have emerged from your mouth that are part of the vocabulary.
I saw a cover of Time magazine once, and they unknowingly, and it was all about flying and aircraft controllers, and the cover was High Anxiety. There's no such thing as high anxiety. I created that. I created it as a title for a movie about psychiatry, to make fun of Hitchcock's
Joe Heller's Catch 22.
Yeah.
There's another. I know he was a friend of yours.
Oh, yeah. I love Joe.
My favorite book of his is Something Happened.
Something Happened is his best book. I love you for knowing that.
Yep.
That's his best book. It's even better. It's better than Catch 22.
There's a lot of Mel Brooks in that book.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Yeah. That that book could make a movie, could make a wonderful movie one day.
What do you have ahead of you?
Well, I hope I don't have a stroke, but ahead of me, I think I love writing songs. I love writing music and lyrics, so I will think about another. Before I do another movie, I think I'm going to examine the possibility of maybe another musical comedy, hopefully a period piece that would lend itself to my insanity and broad, I'd like to meet Broadway again on this wonderful
what
level.
What period?
Well, I mean, if it were one of my movies, let's say I would pick a movie, one of my movies to do, because I probably won't. I'll probably think of something new. But if it were a movie, I would do, I would take Young Frankenstein, do all the sets in black and white, do the costumes in black and white, just like it was a black and white movie. I'd make it a black and white musical. I could see a lot of monsters in a dream as a chorus line dancing with Dr. Frankenstein, I mean, I could see a lot of fun. And we got a guy in our show called Roger Bart. He plays Carmen Gia. Mm-hmm. He's a bit of a genius. Mm-hmm. No one was ever born to play Igor like this since Marty Feldman died, mm-hmm. like this guy, Roger Bart. Mm-hmm. He's talent on wheels. This guy is so fabulous. So, I'm flirting with the idea. I mean, I don't know if it'll happen.
What would be the major love song? What would it be called?
I guess the major love song would be called, I Can Do It, probably. But I have a show stopper called We Can Do It, so I better think of, maybe life after death, death after life, or, Life goes on.
I love you alive or dead.
I love you. You know, well, life goes on after you're dead. Or, it would have to do with the reanimation of dead tissue. That's a good title. It's a very good title for a song.
But the word tissue makes the title.
The reanimation of very dead tissue is what I want to do. You know?
Years ago.
It's a good vaudeville number for
It's
for
fabulous and a very beautiful song and very beautifully sung.
Too. Yeah, please. It's me and vaudeville.
Max Gordon, many years ago, producer.
The producer.
Not the Village Vanguard Max Gordon.
Right.
But this was the David Merrick of the 30s and 20s.
Yeah.
And the Times came to interview him, and they, in a highfalutin way, were asking him all kinds of things that he'd never been asked before.
So what did he say?
And he was asked, Mr. Gordon, do you believe in reincarnation? And this Broadway producer said, but of course I do. I can't believe we close here and don't open somewhere else. And that's true.
That's so beautiful. I mean, look at the metaphor. We close here and don't open somewhere else. Right. I love it.
I will never
see
you again. I'll go now with you to the show.
No, you'll. I promise you I'll be back, and I'll keep hawking my cast album every other Saturday.
Who knows that I will grant you access to me?
Oh, I don't know. Well,
you have plugged this Fakakta album.
Yeah. No. I've done it nowhere.
Here.
You are the only one. You are the first and only place on television or radio that I mentioned it. So that and a Raisin Bran Muffin.
Okay, well, then I'll give you a little wiggle room on that then.
Right. But, I mean, I'm not all over plugging it. I love you. I loved your dad. I thought your father. I'll go my way by myself. Please. One of the great songs of all time. I mean, this man, you know, was takes my heart. My heart.
If we do, in fact, never lay eyes on each other again, I would like to tell you that you mean a great deal to me and a great deal to...
Jonathan, stop. I'm not gay.
I just
want you to know that I am from a straight Jew.
I'm warming to my theme.
Oh, okay.
Which is not a sexual theme.
Okay.
It could, at the end, turn out to be a sexual theme. But at this point, in the warming, it is simply, I want to tell you how much you mean to me, how much you mean to so many of my closest friends, men and women, whose lives have been picked up out of the gutter by just one or two things you might have said on a record, in an interview, in a movie, and now in the theater.
That's poetic.
And
it's beautiful. Thank you for...
honored to have you here.
Oh,
and I thank you for coming, producers or no.
Okay. I love you, Jonathan. Keep in touch. Don't be strange.